Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to encourage people to talk a bit more about the subject of death and dying. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Rhianne Mannings of the charity To Wish, which supports bereaved people and is quite well known now because it was lucky enough to have a visit from Prince William last year, which I know drew quite a lot of attention to the charity, and I'm sure they were glad for it. So, Rhianne, lovely to meet you, and thank you for talking to me. We'll talk about Prince William a bit later, but let's begin by talking about your story, because I know, like so many people, you've established a wonderful charity, but it all started off with a tragic beginning, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Back in 2012, my life changed very, very dramatically, very quickly. I lost my one-year-old son, George, very suddenly. He was happy and smiling one minute, fell ill, was rushed to our local emergency department, but within 2 hours of being admitted, he died. Completely out of the blue, he had shown no signs of any type of illness or anything like that during the day, and it came as an absolute huge shock to our family.
Sounds like a daft question to ask, but how on earth do you even get on with the next day?
You know, I look back, I have no idea how we did, but as many of your listeners will know, that you have to keep going in some way, a different way. So, you know, the next few days were a blur, although there are things I significantly can remember, some of the conversations and the faces of the people we met. But we did carry on, but very alone. We had nothing. Nobody reached out to us. Nobody gave us any information. We were given some phone numbers to call. And 13 years on, I'm still waiting for them to return my call. Nobody knocked on the door. Nobody checked on my other children, who were 2 and 3 at the time. And sadly, my husband really, really did struggle with what we went through in the hospital that evening. And 5 days after we lost George, Paul took his own life. So in 5 days, I lost my husband and my son, and my children lost their baby brother and their amazing dad.
It's a hell of a shock.
Yeah, it is. And I think shock does so many different things to different people. And everyone experiences it differently. But for me, it was just total numbness. I didn't cry for months and months and months. Other people around me did. You know, I was sick a lot. It became quite a physical thing for me. But the whole time you're just wondering how you are going to rebuild your life and how you're going to keep going. And to be honest, at that point, I had no interest in keeping going. I just didn't know how I would put one foot in front of the other.
You say you had no official support, but did you have any kind of family around you who could help?
I was so lucky. And when I share my story, I talk about being very lucky. And I know people look at me strangely when I say that, but you've got to look for those glimmers. And even back then, I was so grateful. I had my sister and her husband who were just amazing and very strong for me and just did everything practically that I needed. But I also had the most amazing parents who, you know, the night George died, picked us up off that floor, came and stayed with us and actually lived with me for a couple of years to just add stability for the other children. So yes, I had more support than a lot of people potentially would, but nobody professionally, nobody from any organisation who could have really come into that chaos and helped us, never did, ever.
I know that people often say, I've had to keep going for my children. Did you kind of feel that at the time, or were you in such a numb state that even that didn't break through to you?
Yeah, and I'm ashamed to admit it sometimes, but I didn't want to be a mum to those children anymore because my life now was just a mess. I blamed myself for creating this mess. I felt the children deserved better than me. I just thought they felt they would be better without me in their lives. I never thought of taking my own life, but I thought a number of times of packing my bags, running away and never coming back. And I didn't have the energy to be a mum to them. You know, I was a mum of 3 amazing children with an amazing husband, and we were a team. And I just wasn't prepared to live as I always called myself a double mum, not a single mum, but I wasn't prepared for that. And I didn't know how I'd do it. So, you know, I resented them at times because I just wanted to lie on the sofa, but I couldn't. And now, you know, 15 years on or 14 years on, I look back and think, gosh, they are really what saved me. It just didn't feel like it at the time.
And picking up on what you talk about blame, isn't it terrible the way we have, it's almost inherent in us to blame ourselves for these tragedies, even when there was absolutely nothing we could have done to prevent any of them?
Yeah, I think blame and guilt, you know, will resonate with a lot of people. When you're having rational days, you understand that actually it wasn't your fault. But when you were in the dark place, and, you know, I still have them and people will have them probably forever, you will always find things like that don't happen, you know, to you. And when they do, you look for why, and there isn't any answers sometimes. So the one reason then it comes back to is that it's you. And, you know, we were lucky again to find out that George died of pneumonia. We were concerned we'd never find out, and some families never find out how their child died, and we were lucky to know. But then you go through that whole, well, I should have known. I should have known he had pneumonia. What did I miss? And even though I've spoken to so many medics and so many people have reassured me that these things sadly can happen, I will always wonder, did I miss something? And with Paul, again, losing someone by suicide is very, very different. Just leaves those questions that sometimes will never get answered. And I'll have those questions forever. But why didn't he speak to me? I should have known. I should have stopped him walking out that day. And it doesn't matter how many books or how much support I get, I will always think I could have stopped that.
Was there no note or anything at all?
No. And I, again, I'm lucky because I know why. You know, I know that he couldn't cope with what happened with George. And actually his inquest was really interesting because it came back as a verdict of accidental death, because they truly believe this man was just bereft, was traumatized, was in a state of just shock and trauma. And that's what led him to end his life. And we all know what happened that day. But to know that the children will know that this wasn't potentially a conscious decision to leave us is something I think they'll hold on to probably for the rest of their lives as well. Now 17 and 18, very hormonal teenagers who, you know, want the same things as any other teenager and drive me up the wall and all of these things. They are the most incredible children who are, or young people now, who I don't think we really realise. I certainly don't realise until I sit down and reflect on really what they've been through. They were 2 and 3 at the time. They watched George fall ill. They watched the paramedics around him and taking him off to hospital. And he never came home again. And then for their daddy to disappear a few days later, you know, I was lucky that Paul worked away from home quite a bit with his job. So I delayed it for about 5 days, saying that he was away working. And then you just have to build a picture for them because, you know, there are people out there, that the experts who told me that I should tell them straight away how he died and what happened. And that is right for some children. For me, it wasn't the right time to tell them. I never lied to them. I just built those building blocks to the truth of he fell, he banged his head, all of these different things, just to make them feel safe, because their whole world had been smashed into all these pieces. But we are very, very close. Very close. We talk very openly about it. I've always talked about them. They've not always wanted to talk back, and that's absolutely fine. I've cried in front of them. I tell them when I'm having bad days. There are pictures around the house still of them. And with the charity, they're both very engaged. Perhaps not as much now that they're teenagers who'd rather be doing other more interesting things, but they still do a lot. And on anniversaries and things, we take time to talk about them. And I think that for me is the key, certainly for my children, was routine and just to keep talking and answering questions as honestly as you can.
And that's what you and I are both about, isn't it? Trying to encourage people to talk about these things. But like you've already said, we don't go around expecting these huge tragedies suddenly to appear out of the blue, do we? And nothing can prepare you for that.
No. And it's not normal to lose your child, you know, and it's trying for them to feel still safe, that this isn't necessarily going to happen again next week, and this isn't something that happens all the time, too much, but not all the time. And part of my grieving process has been worrying that the next thing's going to happen again and again and again. And I never really wanted the children ever to pick up on that, because their lives were very different, but you still want them to experience that innocence of childhood. And a lot of that was taken from them, but my job was to try and still do what I could for them to enjoy their life before it became heavy like it does when you become an adult.
And looking back, can you remember how long it took for the fog to lift, really, for you to feel that, yes, you were going to get up every morning and carry on?
I'm a very positive person, but I'm also very stubborn and determined. And it wasn't long before I realised that these kids needed me to get up in the mornings, however much I resented it and didn't want to do it. And my mum, you know, we all know mums are always right. And sadly, in this case, she was. And I can remember one day just saying to me, "Ree, you're not living, you're existing. And if you are here, you have got to take a grasp on this now, because they need you." And that wasn't long afterwards. And it was quite harsh at the time. And, you know, we probably had a bit of a Barney about it. But she was right. So I did the bare minimum. I'd make sure I got up every morning with them, literally from the day the boys died, and I put them to bed every night, and then they went off to school and nursery. And then I can't remember a moment when the fog lifted, because I was just numb for a long, long time. I can remember going to the funeral, I didn't shed a tear, and my mum was she was concerned I wasn't crying, and I couldn't cry. And then it went on and on. And then I can honestly say it was about 6 years, literally 6 years, before I woke up one day and I couldn't feel my hands, I couldn't feel my feet, I couldn't feel anything. And I went to the doctors and he said, "This is it. You know, you are appreciating what's happened to you." Because till then I wore this mask that many of the listeners will wear. We all wear these masks because it was all right. It's going to be all right. I'm young and I can do this, and I've got the kids, so I'll be fine. And one day it just hit me, the enormity of what happened to me. And I think it's probably the best thing that had happened to me, because I had blocked it out. And you have to accept, you have to face it at some point. And that's when I had to face it. And it was horrendous. I was lucky to get some psychological support. I had some EMDR therapy, which for me changed my whole path going forward. But I can honestly say I will never be the same person again, not because of what I'd also gone through, but because I don't feel the feelings I used to feel. I think you go through these things and become numb, and those feelings do come back, but not the same, not the same.
And we mustn't discount the grief of the people around you, because your mother and father presumably were in a terrible state, having lost a grandchild and a son-in-law.
Yeah, and my mum, they disagree when I say this, but sometimes I think it was harder for them, because they lost their grandson, they lost their son-in-law, who they were extremely close to. Having two daughters, it was a really lovely relationship to have Paul and my dad. But they also lost the daughter that they'd always known. You know, I changed overnight to be this quite angry, at times a bit violent, just a horrible person at times, because I was just so lost. And they also then had to become almost parents for Holly and Isaac. You know, my dad became a father. He was 70 and had to become a father to them at times. He took Isaac to his football and all of these things. And they didn't have that same opportunity as me, who had people coming for coffee and focusing on me, when, you know, they had each other and my sister, but they didn't have the same thing. And they really are the most incredible people. I lost my dad this year, and that has been one of the hardest things I faced ever, considering what I'm talking to you about today. But they generally were the most incredible people who saved me. But nobody ever even checked on them. And they were the ones who were looking after me when they were also drowning.
And was it that lack of support that led you to found the charity, the fact that nobody, no outside officials came to visit your family and check that you were okay? Was that what inspired you in the end?
Yeah, it did. I couldn't, because I had three young children, I saw the incredible support I had as a mother and our family from midwives and health visitors, people who really gave me that support, and I needed it really badly. And people talked about it. There's mother groups you go to, you share your experience, you know, and it's beautiful and joyous. And then your little boy, who is the most happiest little boy with big blue eyes, crawling around, laughing and smiling. 2 hours later, you're holding him and he's gone. And no one, you know, knocked on the door or rang me. And we just felt that nobody cared about us at all. We were a number. But even more importantly, no one cared about George. And no family should have to face that type of loss and be made to feel worse for it. Because you do feel that you are abandoned by a system, by people. And my mental health over the years, I can live with my grief. I want to live with grief. I want to feel, I want to know they're with me. I want to miss them. What I have struggled to live with is the feelings that I'm worthless and that I'm a bad person because this happened to me. And that really could have been prevented if somebody had reached out. And even though people are different, there are common themes and feelings, and someone had put their hand on our shoulder and had said to me and had said to Paul, some of the things you're going to feel, anger and blame and guilt, are normal and we will work through this. Paul took his own life because he truly believed he should have saved his son. He said that to me minutes before he walked out of the house. That should never be something people should feel alone. And I truly stand by the fact that Paul would be here today watching his children grow up if somebody had been there to support us. You know, I think it's really important for people listening, and I know many people listening. It's really sad, isn't it, talking about loss? It's really a difficult subject. We know that, and I know that people sometimes do shy away from talking about it still, of course. But what I try and do by sharing my story, and certainly with To Wish, is talking about hope. It's about hope and making sure that people get that support.
So tell me more about what the charity does, because I know you started in Wales and you've expanded out and you do seem to offer an enormous amount of support. So can you explain it all to me?
To Wish was set up to give hope to families who lost a child or young adult unexpectedly. Seeing what our family went through and that lack of support did make me angry, but also sad to think in a society we live in today, the families are left and abandoned following the loss of somebody so close to them. So I used to be a PE teacher, so didn't really have any idea on anything else but teaching. But I believed even then that this had happened to me for a reason and that Paul and George's lives had to continue. So I actually went and met with the local health board where George died, who obviously knew what happened. And all I asked them was, could I fund a room in the A&E department for bereaved families? I had raised about £25,000 in a couple of months, and that wasn't through trying. People just wanted to donate. But I was actually told that not enough people died in that hospital for the use of that money to create a room. And it's the most hardest thing I've probably heard, especially as what I was talking to them about. But also, it's probably the best thing I heard because it lifted. It just made me, that fire was lit in my stomach to think that actually bereavement is not something that should be ignored for any loss, especially when you lose a child under sudden circumstances. So I started just going out and sharing my story. I realized I didn't want to speak to, you know, the CEOs of these health boards. I wanted to speak to the nurses and doctors in the hospitals who were holding the family's hands and breaking bad news. And I traveled the whole of Wales, just sort of doing a bit of a mapping exercise to see, were we forgotten? Or is this what happens across Wales at the time? And it became clear extremely quickly that it happens every day in hospital where someone dies unexpectedly. If they're older, perhaps the family goes home with a bag of belongings, given a leaflet, and that's it. So that's when I decided I wanted to set up a fund to help our local area. And that has just snowballed because of the gap that I identified into a much larger organisation. And we do a variety of things, but we are very fortunate and proud that we actually work very closely with our health boards and trusts, with the police forces. So no leaflets are handed out. Nobody's sent away to go and find us. We've got an agreement that if a 25-year-old or under dies under sudden circumstances, their information with consent is sent to our organisation, and we phone the family within 48 hours to offer our condolences, but to offer basically anything that family needs. That's not counselling. You know, I know families straight away want to grasp for counselling. It's going to solve everything. But this is just somebody going out into their home, having a cup of tea, talking to them about some of these feelings they may have or may not have, you know, about the funeral, about the process. As many of you know, the listeners will know that sudden death brings a lot of process, the police involvement and things like that. And it was something we trialled, and we just couldn't believe that every family consented to our support. And now it's just grown all across Wales and is growing very, very quickly across England as well. And yeah, we're helping thousands and thousands of people, which is amazing to think that they're not alone anymore.
I love the fact, absolutely love the fact that you've organised it so that you reach out to them. Because as we all know, in that initial ghastly fog of the first few days, you don't know where to turn, and you don't particularly want to turn anywhere, do you, anyway? But to have somebody call you and offer that kind of support.
Yeah, and I think if they don't consent in the hospital, because we do memory boxes as well, which is part of what we do, if they don't consent at the time of death, we then do give them a leaflet and say, ring us anytime you want. And I am a real stickler to make sure that that call is answered. But if they do consent, we will phone them and offer them that support. Now, they may say on that first phone call, thank you so much, but we're doing okay. What our process is, we'll ring back within a week. And then in a week, if they still feel that they're doing okay, we will send our information out to them in the post. And again, then they can come back themselves. But majority say yes to the first, and they pretty much 100% by the time we ring them a week later. So we offer that immediate support for about 4 months. And that's my team that offer that support. And then following that, we have sort of a period of, you know, encouraging them perhaps to go to some of our coffee mornings and to meet other families, come along to some of our social events again to meet families. But then after about 10 months, we will then have counselling available for them as well then. So there's that ongoing talk-in therapy, complementary therapy and things like that. But as we know, we can't bring that in earlier than that, really. It's just not great for shock and trauma. But yeah, and we just want to be there for them. And this isn't just the family. It's important that I add that we support anyone in that ripple. So the family who we would obviously support initially, but we will support the professionals involved, any witnesses involved, any school, any peers. You know, we had a young lad who died. He used to play a lot of rugby. He worked in a sports shop at the weekend. We went into both of those environments to offer them that support because he was driving home from his Saturday job. And that manager felt guilt. And it's trying to get out and seeing if we can just prevent that ripple getting too big that it causes so much pain for so many. You know, lots and lots of ripple. There's a ripple for pretty much every death we receive. We had a young girl who was driving home from a party, and you know, her friend was going to go with her, and her friend didn't go with her in the end. And that's hard. That's a burden to live with when she died and she didn't. You know, you have people who survive the accident and don't die, and they get a lot of obviously grief. But also teachers, you know, we have a lot of youngsters, as many of you know, who go on and take their own life, and they were in school that day, and that teacher completely blames themselves for that because they should have known. Parents, they should have known. You know, they've gone to the shop to pick up milk because mum asked them to, and they've not come home. So it's all of these ripples, but it's also the witnesses. You know, we've had people who have been walking their dogs, minding their own business on a Sunday morning, and have come across an incident and has resulted in the death of a child. Well, they can't go home and just carry on. They're expected to, but actually we will support them as well. And very similarly, after losing the boys, I like answers to as many questions as I can. And I went out and met all the professionals who dealt with my family because it was important. I wanted to thank them, but I also wanted to check they were okay because this was quite unique and it was a really difficult one. And what they said to me, I'd underestimated. And in fact, I've started writing a book to try and bring in them all together so people can really see the impact of grief on everybody involved. You know, George was in nursery the day he died of pneumonia. And the young nursery nurses in their opinions, should have known he was poorly. You know, it's just an awful situation, and people just need that reassurance. They really do. And hopefully Tywyll can bring that. We now work all across Wales, and we realised there was a gap that in England there are some really good organisations. So we want to work with them. It's not about going in and saying we're the best, because we're not. We need to work together. Let's pool our resources. But we now work in Cheshire and Merseyside, all the way down the bordering counties of Wales, Wiltshire, Hampshire, Dorset, Avon, Somerset, Devon, Cornwall, all of these different areas, working with some really great organisations, but also filling some really big gaps in other areas. And we get a little bit of funding in Wales from Welsh Government, which we're really grateful for. But the rest of it's built literally on community fundraising, corporate support. And we do that well. It's hard because it's not always sustainable, but it's important we do it because it builds communities as well. So we're bringing that message into communities as much as anything. I've got an incredible team. I've learned a lot from being that PE teacher. I've now got 50 paid members of staff who offer our service. Obviously, have to fundraise for us, and obviously the back office staff there as well. And they're incredible. You know, they really are. And we do make a difference to families. And I think, you know, Paul and George were never going to be forgotten. I didn't realise how this would go. And I'm just proud that their lives mattered that much, that people still remember them because of it.
I bet they're very proud of you too.
I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? Paul was a very private person and his photos splashed everywhere. So he's probably not the best impressed of that. But what I always think was he'd just be pleased to think I'd found a way through it. And if this is the way getting through it, I think he'll be pleased, because I know that he would want to be here today if he really had that chance.
Now, I know that the charity got a bit of a boost, didn't it, when you were visited by Prince William recently. I guess that was very helpful, was it, in terms of bringing the organisation to everybody's attention?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I've met him quite a few times. He's been incredibly supportive of my journey, but also of the organisation. And I had a call out the blue just saying that we're part of the Suicide Now Prevention Network across the UK, led by the Royal Foundation, which is just an incredible honour for us. And he wanted to come out on Suicide Prevention Day to come out to speak to me really about Paul. It was quite a personal discussion around Paul and the effects of that has had on our lives and on our families, and what Tywyll now does as well. But I never expected him to want to come to my home, I giggled a lot about that to start with, because I was just like, this is crazy. And yeah, he came, he pulled up on the drive with a driver, jumped out, came in, had a cup of tea and some Welsh cakes with me, met my children and was wonderful with them. It was really good to hear somebody in his position talk openly about what we've talked about, but behind closed doors probably. He met my mum, a sister, and it was just amazing. And us and Kensington Palace, totally and utterly never expected the story to go viral, which it did across the world. We were inundated with both requests for everything, donation, everything. It was a whirlwind, real whirlwind, but an amazing one as well, and something I'll never forget.
I thought it was fascinating that he got quite emotional in front of you, didn't he? And I think that so often happens to people who are bereaved, doesn't it? That we find ourselves in the position of looking after other people.
Just because of who he is as well doesn't mean he's immune to this, isn't it? And he's been through, and going through so many different things, and he has to wear this public mask. And he got emotional that you all saw, but there was a number of emotional moments. There was a lot of hugs. You know, he got emotional in front of my family. And I just think it shows that he's in touch with what's going on. And I just hope that people are looking after him as well, because, you know, it's hard. And I just naturally just wanted to throw my arms around him. So I'm glad he hugged me first, because then I could hug back. Because you've got to also remember that he is the future king. So you've got to be careful. But he makes you feel so relaxed. You sometimes forget that.
Well, I'm glad it brought you to everybody's attention. That must have been wonderful. Thank you, Rhianne, so much for talking to me. I'm very glad to have met you, and I think you're doing wonderful work. So thank you for all of that.
And thank you. And you're also helping raise profile of tuition. If there's anyone listening who live in those areas or perhaps can't remember where we work, go on our website, www.tuition.org.uk. You will see what we provide, and we can then you know, we can hopefully help you or anyone that you're concerned about. But thank you for having me, and it's been really lovely to meet you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.